the prophecy of Zephaniah, as we're going to see, is much more expansive than Habakkuk. It follows it as the next book. And I want you to remember all the lessons that Brother Russ brought out in the last discourse. However, Zephaniah is from the king just before. Okay. So we're looking at the next book of the Bible, but actually time-wise, this was the book that preceded the prophecy of Habakkuk. And brethren, we are seeing things fulfilled before our eyes. We are seeing those elements being dissolved. And what an encouragement to us both to lift up our heads that our salvation draws nigh, and at the same time to be a light to this world that needs it so much. And Zephaniah comes at a fascinating time. Usually we pass over the first verse as just so much, talk about backgrounds of who was the son of who, Isaiah's the son of Amos. We find out here in Zephaniah something that is unique in the prophets. He gives his lineage, but he gives it for four generations. That's unusual. And there's a reason for that. If you look at his lineage, it says the word of the Lord came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushi. We'll get to that right at the end. The son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of, that's actually the same Hebrew word as Hezekiah, the great king at the time of Isaiah. But we're told that this is specifically in the days of Josiah. So as we look at this prophecy, we want to see what was happening in the days of Josiah. And there's some fascinating lessons from that in terms of what people try to do with good heart intention, but ultimately the Lord brings the judgment because there's no other way to bring correction. But when we pick up on that phrase that it was from the time of King Josiah, what do we know about his reign? A lot. We know a great deal about the reign of King Josiah. He was one of the bright spots in the kings that Judah had. Now, just to remind you of the history, there had been 12 tribes until Solomon passed away. Because of poor judgment, the Lord overruled. So there was a split. Most of the 12 tribes went to what they continued to call as Israel, with the capital at Samaria. And that continued until there was an invasion by the Assyrians. And Brother Russ mentioned the Assyrians and how they literally would put the hooks in the lips of the captives. The two tribes were not Judah and Levi, because Levites were amongst all the tribes. It's Judah and Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin. Those are the two tribes. And remember that Jerusalem is a very unusual city. The part that David conquered in the south, the almost impregnable part that became known as Zion, belonged to Judah. The part of the city towards the north where the temple was, according to the promise, belonged to Benjamin. So Jerusalem had both of the tribes with a claim to that city. You remember what was the tribe that King Saul came from? Benjamin. Okay, Benjamin. Okay, so Benjamin and Judah are linked together, and they're continuing now. The line of David is continuing in the city of Jerusalem itself, and we find a boy of 8 years old brought to the throne, and he reigned 31 years. When you do the math, you say, wait a minute, 39, that's not particularly aged, and we're going to see what happened. But he began, even at that age, to seek after the God of his father. Now, literally, he seems to have led troops that went around and started cutting down the groves, the high places where there would be the carved images to Baal, and taking the molten images. We're told that at the age of his 12th year, so that would be age 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves, the carved images, the molten images. They break down the altars of Balaam in his presence. So he was there. He didn't just send deputies around to do it. He was personally purging the land. He broke the images into pieces. He made dust of them, strewed it upon the graves of them that sacrificed to Baal. And he burnt the bones of the priests on the altars and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. And he didn't stop there. The Assyrian Empire was falling apart at this point. He went beyond that into where the 10 tribes had been and did the purging there. Now, let us not have any sympathy for the priests of Baal who were slain during this time. Keep in mind that they were the most abominable child sacrificers, and the eating of the flesh. Since to this day we use the term cannibal or priest of Baal to indicate those that eat the flesh. But going all the way up into Naphtali, that's as far north as and Dan are as far north as you can get, he broke down the altars, the groves, and he did a thorough cleansing work throughout Jerusalem. What a king. What a good king. And the scriptures commend him. He didn't stop there. After he'd done that purging, he went back to the temple itself. It needed repairs, and he started the repair work. He went, and we're told that in year 18 of his reign, that would be at the age of 26, he started the repairs, and then something remarkable happened. There's some debate amongst the scholarly community on this, but it said that they found the book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. Now, we find this in 2 Chronicles 34, and there's some debate. This, in fact, may have been the actual writing that Moses had done on the papyrus. The papyrus was available at the time of the Exodus. This may have been the actual writing, or it may have been a copy. But in any case, nobody knew what was in it. There had been such a lapse of religious fervor and study that nobody was familiar with the words of the five books. Well, in the temple complex, we find there was a prophetess. We wouldn't know anything about her were it not for this small incident. And she was in charge of taking care of the wardrobe for the temple priesthood. Her name was Huldah, but she went and prophesied. And we're going to read what she says in 2 Chronicles 34. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon this place and upon the inhabitants thereof, even all the curses that are written in the book, which they have read before the king of Judah, as the book was brought before Josiah, and he heard the words, he had ripped his clothes in anguish. And this was going to come because they had forsaken me and have burned incense unto other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with the works of their hands. Well, Huldah did not stop there. She did make a statement that recognizing how sincere Josiah had been, she said, "You shall go to your grave in peace." That was something the Lord granted to Josiah. Now, Josiah and his supporters were sincere in their reforms, but the resistance to the reform was even stronger. So think about all those wonderful things. We saw the pictures of the groves being cut down, the idols being ground up, and then think of the story, the account we just had from Habakkuk of all of that getting reestablished almost as fast as Josiah was off the scene. He was sincere. He had sincere followers, but in general, the nation was not with him. And so, we read about this. I'd like you to turn to Zephaniah, the first chapter, verses 4-6. It says, I'm going to add some interpretive reading. It's not going to be clear unless you're an expert in Hebrew as to what is being said here. It says, I'll cut off the remnant of Baal from this place and the name of the Chemarims. What are Chemarims? The translating community thinks that these were the priests that served the idols. Okay, so perhaps you have that as a footnote. With the priests. Now, these are the priests of Jehovah, but nominal priests of Jehovah. And them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops. Well, you know, he could cut down the groves, he could grind up the images of Baal, he could break down the altars, but, you know, they could still sneak an idol up onto the housetop there for worship, and that indeed was what was happening. And them that worship and swear by the Lord. Oh, that sounds good. And that swear by Malcolm. Oh, you mean the Lord just wants us to swear by him? And I mean, you know, Malcolm's got some power. That's the Hebrew word for king. This was one of the other idols. And them that have turned back from the Lord. This is a group that just turned off their back on religion completely. A very modern thinking group. And have not sought the Lord nor inquired of him. Well, again, brethren, we know there were some faithful Levites. We know there were some, there's always a residue of those whose hearts are in the right direction and that will enjoy the Lord's blessing even in trial and tribulation. But the Lord was going to condemn those that were nominally serving him. And so while Josiah's reforms were the brightest period in Judah's history, there was an Assyrian invasion prophesied that was going to be ravaging the land, and not just Judah. It was ravaging everything, Philistia, Judah, and we read about that in 2 Kings. But we're going to get back to that part of the account. The Lord says that in this destruction, he really wants to take away the mixed religion. You remember thinking about the church, the third church, the Pergamos, the mixed marriage, Betty, around Gamos, marriage, it's a mixed marriage. You say, well, gee, that's really unusual. But in fact, you know, looking at this as an anthropologist would look at it, which I think is the right way to look at it here, this is typical. This is not unusual. The reign of Josiah was important, but the people also wanted to worship their other gods, saying, well, you know, hey, Jehovah has power, no question. Malcolm has power, we better swear by him. Queen of heaven, you know, we won't be fertile without her blessing, so we got to swear up to her and sacrifice. I'm picking out an example here of something that goes back into period when the North countries were coming into a form of Christianity. And, of course, they hedged their bets. You know, you see the Christian cross surrounded by the serpent. That would have been the pre-Christian form of religion. That's going back in history. Let's bring it up to stuff that could be happening today and does happen today. Let's just take a look close by at New Orleans. If you looked at a voodoo altar, you would find not only the honoring of the false gods, but Mary, Jesus, and of course the devils are being honored as well, just to highlight some of that on the altar. This is typical, the mixed worship. Why does the Lord have to destroy it? Because you don't go from this to saying, you know, I'd really like to get more familiar with my scripture studies, and there's not an organic growth from this into an understanding of the Lord's word. This is for those of us who go back to a period, an ancient period of time where there were 33 and a third rotation per minute records, you would know what would happen when a groove would be damaged and it might just keep going around and playing and playing and playing and play, you know, until you actually physically move. And that's sort of what this mixed religion is. It was a cultural dead end. It wasn't going to ever go anywhere as long as it was mixed. And this is the problem the Israelites have. The people who are worshiping the devils here at this altar, even though they've got Jesus, Mary, and a couple other saints up there, are never going to get out of that rut. Okay? That's why the judgment had to come, to end the mixed religion. The judgment had to come. Well, Josiah didn't stop in his efforts to reform. He did something. He was faced now with two prophecies because he had the prophecy from Zephaniah. In fact, there's reason to believe that was before Huldah's prophecy. And the reason's going to get into some of the details of how you harmonize the history in this period we'll be talking about. Faced with these challenges, Josiah said, you know, I'm looking in the book and it says at the beginning of the year, 14th day, the beginning of the religious year, we have to have a Passover. And so he gave instructions that there should be a great Passover. We read about this again in Chronicles. It says, and the children of Israel that were present kept the Passover at that time and the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days, and were told that there was not a Passover like this. There had not been a Passover like this since the days of the prophet Samuel. Since before there was even a king. What a reform. What a wonderful man Josiah was. Wasn't discouraged. He kept saying, look, and this is so commendable. We need to be doing the right thing. He didn't just give up. He didn't say, well, que sera, sera. You know, it's going to happen. Let's just go. And he was saying, we need to get our hearts back to the Lord. And he put that into practice to the best of his ability. Now, previously, there's something that's interesting to me here, and that's in the Lord's extending of grace. Between the time of the great Passover and the time of the invasion that is going to be changing the whole history of Judah, we have a period of 13 years. Between Ahab's death and the death of Jezebel, don't conflate those two things in your mind, because I know I did. Those are 14 years apart. The fact that these periods of time where the Lord does something and then shows a period of grace, that actually is the time for a young man in Israel or Judah to go through bar mitzvah to come into the covenant, to become a son of the covenant. This is 13 years. I don't think it's an accident that it's 13 or 14 years here. But we're told that those two periods are the same. I think there's a point being made. We read in Zephaniah this scripture that is an instruction to the world, to those that are going in a direction of righteousness, certainly to the church. But this is a general instruction. Seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, that have wrought his judgment. We certainly hope that's not the church. That should not be the church. Seek meekness. It may be that ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's wrath. Well, as we get into Zephaniah, we find that first he, his standpoint's in Jerusalem. So we're going to keep marking Jerusalem on the map, and he first announces judgment against the Philistines. He says this, Gaza shall be forsaken. Yep, that's the Gaza of the Gaza Strip. Ashkelon shall be a desolation. They shall drive out Ashdod. At noon, Ekron shall be rooted up. Woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast. That's the Philistines, the nation of the Cherethites. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, and the land of the Philistines, and I will destroy you. So he looks west and says that, and I just thought you might be helped. There's Jerusalem, directly to the west, directly to the west. This is the area that was under Philistine control. And there's the specific cities mentioned in order, going from south to north, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron. First, the judgment looks in that direction. Then, turning from the west, he looks to the east. And he pronounces judgment against the kingdoms of Ammon and Moab. And this judgment is even more severe because it says, therefore as I live, saith the Lord, surely Moab shall be as Sodom, the children of Ammon as Gomorrah, even the breeding of nettles and salt pits in a perpetual desolation, and the residue of my people shall spoil them, and the remnant of my people shall possess them. There was, at this time, going back actually anciently, there was what was called the King's Road that went through these kingdoms and brought the commerce. You might recall that when Solomon sent forth some trading ships, they came all the way up, and in fact, they would have been using some of those roads in all likelihood to transport some of their goods and get them as far north as Jerusalem. But this was a very active area commercially, and that was coming to an end. Now, here's where I spent a lot of time, brethren, going through this, because it was a big history lesson for me. It says, looking to the south, Zephaniah pronounces judgment against Egypt. And here's what he says. Ye Ethiopians also, ye shall be slain by the sword. Well, wait a minute. Why is he talking about Ethiopia? Why is he not talking about Egypt? And this really is great because it helps actually to date this particular prophecy. What I'm showing here, you might say, well, that's kind of interesting. It sort of looks like a pyramid. Doesn't have a capstone, but it certainly is not a pie angle pyramid like the Great Pyramid of Giza. These were pyramids by the Nubians. This was the group of peoples that lived to the south of Egypt, as far as the Israelites were concerned, they would be considered Ethiopians. Anybody who came from that, the Hebrew word there is Cush. Of course, they are descendants of Cush. And we find it going back into history that there was about a 100-year period where they had moved down the Nile from what was the interior of Africa, cataract by cataract, waterfall by waterfall, till they actually controlled not only Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt means the part that's higher and more inland, and Lower Egypt, that's where you have the Nile Delta. Okay, so if you, let's just flip back on this map of Egypt for a second. Two important cities in Egypt, and they're right here by the delta, is the very critically important city of Memphis in ancient times. Okay, Memphis. And there's actually a city nearby that's named the same thing in honor of that. Today we call that Cairo. That was where the Great Pyramid was, but that's not where the religious center was. Remember, the Great Pyramid was not built as a tomb. It's a special altar unto the Lord. The religious center was upriver a little further at a place called Thebes. So those are the two big Egyptian cities you've got to know. Memphis should be easy to remember. Okay? Thebes, a little tougher to remember, but that's where the so-called Valley of the Kings was. And that was the religious center for Egypt's life. So just a couple references, because, you know, this is an area where the history that there were Nubian kings is very clear. Getting their relationship sorted out is also pretty clear at this point, and the length of their reigns is pretty clear. Just a couple references if you want to look further into that from, what do we have here, the Harvard Theological Review, and then one of the leading journals on Near Eastern Studies. Zephaniah then announces judgment against Assyria itself, looking to the north. Okay, so he's looked every cardinal direction of the compass. And he says this, he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria and make Nineveh a desolation and dry like a wilderness, which happened. Of course, later Nineveh got rebuilt on the outskirts of Nineveh. We know it by the modern name of Mosul, Iraq. And, well, things haven't been going all that well in Mosul lately. No. Okay, so that was a picture from July. Things are not doing too well there. But once again, the Lord warns Judah, and that's the point of the grace. This judgment does not fall without a warning, and it does not fall without even a reasonable period of time. We can see this in chapter 3, where we pick up these words. Woe unto her that is filthy and polluted, to the oppressing city, because she obeyed not the voice. She received not correction. She trusted not in the Lord. She drew not near to her God. Her princes within her are ravening, roaring lions, and her judges are evening wolves. They gnaw not the bones till the marrow. You have those of you that are dog lovers like myself know that, you know, get that bone out to the dog there and it's gone. Her prophets are light and treacherous persons. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary and done violence to the law. The just Lord. Now remember, this isn't just a matter of the Lord doing this on a whim. There's justice involved with the trouble and judgment that comes. The just Lord is in the midst of her. He will not do iniquity. Every morning doth he bring his judgment to light, and faileth not. But the unjust knoweth no shame. The unjust knoweth no shame. They don't get it. So the Lord has to give it to them in a way they can't miss. And then the Lord warns the other nations again. He says this, continuing on in verses 6 and 7 of the third chapter, I've cut off the nations. Their towers are desolate. I'll make their streets waste that none passeth by. Their cities are destroyed so that there is no man and there is none inhabitant. I said, surely thou wilt fear me. Thou wilt receive instruction, so their dwelling should not be cut off. However, I punished them, but they rose early and corrupted all their doings. They didn't get it. Well, what happened is Pharaoh Necho, who is specifically identified in the scriptural account, and it's actually Pharaoh Necho II, reasserted native Egyptian rule and led an army to fight at Carchemish. And it's like, where's that? What is he talking about? We're going to give you a map right away. What's important about this is you remember the prophecy of Zephaniah specifically referenced the Nubians. And now when we see the fight that Josiah is going to be engaged in, we are not dealing with the Nubians. They have been pushed back up the cataracts, back towards the interior of Africa. And that is important because that helps us to date this period. That is a critical thing. Here's what's happening. We have Egypt coming up this way. They're trying to get to Carchemish. That's all the way in Turkey, okay? This is the Euphrates River comes up, and there's two places that are really almost, I hate to say something ideal for war, but these are where it is easy to deploy large troops. One of them's Megiddo, one of them's Carchemish. That's really the promised boundary of Israel, because it says unto the great river, even the river Euphrates. That is a northern boundary. Some brethren say, oh, well, the land is all the way over to here. No, that is not good scholarship. I flatly disagree with that. The Euphrates is the northern boundary of Israel. They should have all of Lebanon. It's actually into Turkey. That is the promised land. And they always understood to the Euphrates to mean at this point, you'd come up, and this is where you could turn and start going down the coast. There's a large plain there at Carchemish, and some very significant historical battles took place. So here's the forces. The Assyrians, along with a group called the Scythians, we'll talk more about them, are coming to battle against the Babylonians, who are allied with the Medes. You say, wait a minute, I thought the Medes were allied with the Persians. Well, the Medes were opportunistic. Babylon was a strong power, they allied with Babylon. Persia became a strong power, they allied with Persia. Okay, so they're coming up, and it turns out that Josiah decides he's going to fight at Megiddo. Now, just keep in mind, Judah's down here. All of this part, Megiddo is right on an area close to the coast. We know that Pharaoh Necho actually had a fleet, a supply fleet, assisting him going up the coast, and he's taking the land army, leading it up the coast. It's been a great question, why did Josiah decide that he was going to engage in this battle? And we read this in Josiah. Here's the account from, we'll start with 2 Kings. It's in Chronicles in more detail. In Josiah's day, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up against the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates. That's Carchemish. And King Josiah went up against him. And he, Necho, slew Josiah at Megiddo. Okay. Well, that, like, what's Josiah trying to do? Well, as it turns out, the translation is muddled. In Josiah's day, Pharaoh Necho went up against, and I'm not going to go into the details, but you can see those are two different strong words from the Strong's Concordance. The one that is, they're both translated against, as in for a fight, but this one clearly is the word for a fight. The other one is, the evidence suggests that there had been collusion between Egypt and the crumbling Assyrian Empire, and Egypt was coming to assist Assyria against their fight with Babylon. And what did King Josiah want to do? He knew how much damage Assyria had done to the nation. They had taken away the 10 tribes and replaced them with Samaritans. They had permitted all the abominable worship just got even more horrific under Assyria. And he knew that he was massively outnumbered, but he thought, apparently, this is the thesis that I'm going to set before you. This is not something you'll find in most of the commentaries, but I'll give you there's a reference on this, from a peer-reviewed journal. He was thinking that if he could do anything to delay the Egyptian advance, to make them line up their armies, you know, stop the wagons that are carrying the supplies and get them to deploy, he could prevent them from reinforcing the Assyrians in time, and that this would be the end of Assyria. And indeed, this battle at Carchemish apparently was the end of Assyria, and the Egyptians weren't there to assist. So I think that's a very reasonable thesis. But if you go to even some really good quality commentaries, you won't find that thesis set forth. The evidence for that comes from some Egyptian writings that show that both Egypt and Assyria had already been allied the year before this battle took place. And so based on that, the speculation is no. You didn't have Pharaoh Necho going up to fight against Egypt. He was going, with Egypt to fight against Assyria. He was going up there to assist Assyria. And that's why Josiah was trying to interrupt him. But study it for yourself, brethren. I encourage you to make this your own. Get into the history. History is philosophy, teaching by example, as the Greeks have said. And that is something that I agree with. The scriptures lay the blame on Josiah for his death. He apparently decided that when Huldah said, "You will go to your grave in peace," that this was like a shield of invincibility around him, which it was not. It was just a promise. He did not inquire of the Lord. He did this with his own thinking. And, you know, he did it with good intentions. The Assyrians really were bad. But what he didn't know was that Babylon was going to be even worse. Okay, we had that from Brother Russ's talk. So this is the way the NIV quotes Pharaoh Necho. "What quarrel is there between you and me, O King of Judah? It's not you I'm attacking at this time." That's the part that I love. You know, that little nuanced phrase in the diplomatic language. "I'll get you another time. No, I'm not attacking you at this time, but the house with which I am at war." And actually, because of that, most of the commentators think that he was going to fight against Assyria. But the reality was he had already made a secret agreement. And they were allies, and he was going to assist them. "God's told me to hurry, so stop opposing God who is with me, or he will destroy you." Well, that's the last word the scriptures give on the subject. Now, I believe that one of the first acts of our returned Lord was the binding of Satan. And that is not something that all the brethren agree to, and that's okay. You know, we need to study these things and establish them in our own minds. But I'm going to illustrate why I think that is the case and what typically happens in that kind of a case. Once Assyria was out of the way, I mentioned that they had these unreliable allies, the Scythians. In fact, they come from the Black Sea area. They were wide-ranging. They really enjoyed having their images wrought in good style in gold there. They liked gold. And you can see, for those of you that are horse lovers, this is not a Tennessee Walker. This is one of those cold blood ponies that are very reliable. You can see there's no saddle, no stirrups. But there's the Scythian rider. This one is shown with a spear, but they were expert using the bow off the horse, or by foot using the bow. And we also have some nice pictures from the palace of Nineveh. Why do I mention this? Once these were really wild horsemen. If the Cossacks are their descendants, which of course the Cossacks think they are, those were the sort of shock troops that the Soviet forces held till the end when they were on the outskirts of Berlin. Then they let the worst go to ravage the city. They're ruthless. They scalped people, for example. And they had a lot of other unhappy customs that we won't get into, my dear. So.
Thank you.
Okay. But what is important is the book doesn't stop here. And I brought up this issue on the binding of Satan because what happens is when the really bad guy's out of the way, you find out that some of the lieutenants serving him, like the Scythians were serving the Assyrians, they're even worse. They're even worse. And so that's, I'll just set that forth. That's one of my reasons. Yeah, no, evil doesn't go away when the adversary is restrained. You have his crazy lieutenants each vying for power and showing that they're seven times worse. In this, we can see a picture of the end times. It says, "Wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey." And now we're looking at a picture that was shown in type by what was happening in Zephaniah's day and Josiah's day. But now this one is end of the age and much bigger. It says, "For my determination is to gather the nations, all the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger, for all the earth shall be devoured in the fire of my jealousy. For then, when the Lord's gotten their attention, will I turn unto the people a pure language, that they may call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent." Rotherham makes an important note. He says, with one shoulder, and I got the picture of these men pushing the disabled car along. That's the poetic image that's being given here for the one shoulder. Everybody putting their shoulder to the task of moving something. And we're even told something very interesting to me. I've had a great privilege of being able to travel with Brother Homer and Sister Kathy over to Africa. There's a special promise to Ethiopia in the next verse. It says, "From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my suppliants, thank you, even the daughter of my dispersed shall bring my offering." And, you know, we really find that there's such an open door of opportunity that's there. I'm specifically picturing brethren that have, this is Brother Nicholas Towe, that's Brother Endemutsu, if I'm remembering that right. We're looking at brethren that are coming in from countries where there has not been a Bible student setting foot, but they've gone on the internet. They've been looking for something that's reasonable, and they found the truth. Wow, this is a new era, brethren. This is different. This is different. So I'm just showing a picture from that actually goes back to the last Pan-African convention in April of 2016. We're told that in that day thou shall you not be ashamed for all of the transgressions, for everything that's done. This is finally going to break the arrogance, the pride, the ones that don't learn or pick up. They will come to recognize that they have transgressed. And that'll be the blessing, because you can't, you know, it's like, well, shouldn't we just forgive 70 times 70? You've got to get repentance from the heart on the part of those that are going to change. And that will be the case for mankind. He says, "I'll take out of thee them that rejoice in thy pride." So we need to keep our eyes open. If there are things that exhibit pride, we don't want that. If there's leaders that exhibit pride, they're going in the wrong direction. "And thou shalt no more be haughty because of my holy mountain." They will finally recognize, yes, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. And if you remember the next verse in that chapter of Revelation, it says, "And the nations rejoiced." They were angry. They were angry when they found that, but no. Zephaniah ends on such a positive upbuilding note. So I'm glad we're ending with this, even though Habakkuk really is the correct book to follow this with. We're told that I will leave in the midst of you an afflicted and poor people, but they're going to trust in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel shall do no iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth, for they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Well, surely that is a kingdom picture. That is not something that happened in the days of Josiah. We're told that the daughter of Zion would be shouting and singing. We're told that there's going to be gladness in this time. We're told that the Lord would take away judgments, we're told that even Jerusalem itself, the focal point of all this trouble, would come back and no longer and not be slack. They will be strong in working for the Lord. Promises in the 15th and 16th chapter of Zephaniah. We're told that the Lord God in the midst is mighty and that he will rejoice with joy. And here's that interesting scripture that says he will rest in his love and joy over thee with singing. Oh, to hear that voice in song. But there's got to be trouble first before the singing. We're told that, behold, at this time, I'll undo all that afflict thee, and will save her that halteth. In other words, the ones that are physically disabled, either literally or halting in a spiritual sense. Gather her that was driven out, and get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. What a promise. What a promise. And the closing of this book, at that time I will bring you again, even in the time that I gather you, for I will make you a name and a praise among all the people of the earth when I turn back your captivity before your very eyes, saith the Lord. Well, brethren, let's summarize. You know, even the best of political leaders, with the best intention, the best of instruction, cannot change people's hearts. That's the lesson of Josiah. The Lord's judgment falls both on his covenant people, because judgment must begin with the house of God, and that's just a general principle. But it also falls on the other nations that have not known God. The Lord gives ample warning time. How long have the saints been advising this world that the kingdom is not what you see in front of you, but it is with the Christ, head and body, and that it is on different principles? The Lord gives ample warning. In the end, the trouble has to come because people just don't believe until the trouble comes. It's not that we want it. It's not that we enjoy it. We certainly don't enjoy it. Our hearts go out. The Lord will sing with joy over the change that will be coming. And that's where we want to close with our considerations and our thoughts, brethren. And we just pray that you would have strength and ability and an open mouth to tell the people about the reason for this trouble. It's not because this party did wrong, that party did wrong, this world conspiracy did wrong. All of that's going. It's because